Welcome to episode 144 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, a family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
And I'm Gary Ferencik, the general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. We are recording again on the winter solstice. And so that means that today is the shortest day of the year. And in today's Washington Post, there was a really interesting article that basically showed that the winter solstice can occur anywhere between December 20th and December 23rd. And that the name is derived from the Latin solstitium, which is the literal translation, sun standing still. So if you can imagine that in the summer solstice, the days get longer, the sun keeps moving further and further to the south, and today the sun will stop and start moving back north again.
Yes.
Way, yay.
It's one of those things that I never really thought about a lot, but when we have a home up on Lake Michigan and we have great sunsets there. And we've been there as that day where the sun is as far over as it's going to get. And then it starts back in the other direction. And that
sun's Can you actually see it move?
If you drink enough, yes.
So this podcast,
we have like poems or patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get all of them, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com, where you get the reference plus a poem every day. All year long, the opinions expressed on Primary Care Updates are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit. Go to IAFP.com, click on their education webpage to find our podcast. This week, we're going to talk about time to improvement of lower extremity cellulitis, time for CGRP MABs to take effect in adults with chronic migraine, cognitive behavioral therapy for fatigue in patients with long COVID, and outcome data for various lipid-lowering strategies. Kate, take it away, please.
I'm still looking for Henry's solstice article here in the Washington Post. I'll pay more attention. I have an article this week about, as Mark said, how long it takes for the symptoms of lower extremity cellulitis to get better. I thought this was very applicable to my essentially everyday practice. So these investigators analyzed data from a randomized controlled trial. That part turns out to be interesting in a second. The studies, that trial included 247 adults, average age about 52, in England who had lower extremity cellulitis without any obvious abscess. The included patients had signs and symptoms for about 3.5 days before seeking treatment, so about right. Kind of gets worse for a few days, then you're like, fine, I'll go to the doctor. All the patients were treated with flucloxacillin or flucloxacillin plus clindamycin. So flucloxacillin, as I'm sure you all know, not used in the U.S. It's similar in spectrum to dicloxacillin. I looked that up. We use that most frequently for mastitis in my case. Everybody was evaluated at baseline 5 days out and about 10 days out for both pain and via visual comparison with the unaffected limb. They did some measurements, some other things. They did some blood studies as well. So overall, there was a reduction in average limb circumference in the affected limb over 10 days of follow-up, but there was still a 2-centimeter difference or greater in about a third of patients at day 10. So you think, well, that swelling should go right down, but again, about a third still had at least a 2-centimeter difference. Signs like local warmth, local signs of inflammation were still present at day 10 in about a third. Some pain was present in at least half of individuals, with about 14% reporting a pain score of 5 or more at day 10. They had done, as I mentioned, a bunch of biomarkers of infection, white blood cell count, neutrophil count, things like that. They did improve. So people, again, clinically getting better, they reported that they felt better. Blood counts were getting better by day 3, but the signs and symptoms did persist. Data collection didn't extend beyond 10 days. So there's no sort of, Kaplan-Meier curve to sort of say exactly how long did it get better. I was curious to find out why that was. This was a secondary study from the PATCH trial that was published a few years ago. Patients were randomized to penicillin or no penicillin to try and reduce the incidence of recurrent cellulitis. So they then had to begin, after they finished their course of flucloxacillin, they then were randomized to penicillin or no penicillin. So that's why they didn't have further data, because they then initiated either penicillin or no penicillin. For the record, it didn't work. there was no difference in the penicillin versus no penicillin group in the incidence of recurrent cellulitis. So in spite of successful treatment, in spite of signs of some clinical improvement, signs and symptoms of lower extremity cellulitis can take longer than 10 days. We can't be precise on how much longer, but it's certainly substantially longer. Doesn't mean that your treatment hasn't worked, just means that it takes longer than 10 days for that skin or soft tissue infection to really improve.
Thanks, Henry. Kate. That's a great summary. Henry, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's probably true that at the big gestalt level that the signs and symptoms probably persist beyond the actual cure, if you will. I'm just not sure about their definition of cure, that biomarkers, I don't think, are great measures of cellulitis, and patient symptoms can be a good indicator of from their end. But if you really want to know if there's biological cure, yeah, I wonder who would sign up for the study that involved either doing tissue culture or biopsies of their cellulitis to determine if it's truly active or not.
Kate, did they say how long they treated him for? I'm looking at your abstract here, and it doesn't look like there's a duration of treatment. Were they all treated for the exact same duration?
Yeah, they were. Okay. Everybody, if they had been on something before they were entered into the trial, they were all switched to either one of those two medications. Because, again, the trial wasn't studying this. It was studying after you effectively treated it, after that course of therapy. Then they were interested in this recurrence question of
my temptation as a clinician would be, well, you just need a longer duration of antibiotics if you're still symptomatic, you know what I mean? So it's interesting to know that these people were not being treated at the time they were still symptomatic. So it would put me in a little bit of a conundrum in terms of whether we need to extend the duration or whether or not this is just the natural history, which I think this abstract is actually trying to argue for.
I mean, it seems like you would probably be able to individualize it too. You know, if a patient, the 2/3 of patients who were doing much better, or half of patients, they wouldn't need longer antibiotics. And I think maybe a longer period, or maybe it's just inflammation that takes longer to resolve than we think. You know, lower extremity swelling is going to be hard to resolve unless you're really good about elevating.
Mark, I think you once said in one of our live courses that every study of antibiotic duration essentially always says the same thing, which is that you can get away with less.
Yes. I've never seen one where longer is better. All right. I got the quiz. My turn. Okay. So for which of the following is there randomized controlled trial evidence of reduced pain following total knee arthroplasty? And in 5 days, I will find out. You can choose more than one. Gabapentin, dexamethasone 10 to 20 milligrams intraoperatively, adductor canal nerve block, local infiltration of analgesia intraoperatively around the knee, squirt it all in there, and then femoral nerve block. Stay tuned. Henry, are you ready?
Yeah, well, good luck on your surgery. Well, you shouldn't need luck, right? You just need a good surgeon.
I don't think it's like good luck. Am I tossing coins here? What? It's like roulette. Russian.
Yeah. So my poem basically tries to ask, how long do you need to treat patients with the calcitonin gene-related peptide monoclonal antibodies before they get a response? So this was an interesting cohort study of about 800 individuals who had at least 8 migraines per month, and they were getting care in headache centers in Italy. They had to fail 3 or more other preventive strategies, okay? And they were going to be taking one of the CGRP monoclonal antibodies, okay? As part of the study, they had to keep headache diaries both for 28 days before starting to get sort of the baseline assessment of what happens, as well as throughout. At the end of the 24 weeks, they had some really interesting things. So first of all, almost 90% took erenumab, quote, due to asynchronous access of these drugs to the national health system reimbursement. I think that's a euphemism for this was the only thing that was approved at the time, okay? And that the others got other drugs for through other means, okay? What they found was that on average, these individuals failed at least five preventive therapies. So this was a particularly afflicted group of individuals. At the end of 12 weeks, about two-thirds of the individuals reported at least a 50% reduction in headache frequency, so a clinically meaningful improvement. After 24 weeks, though, that what they found was just over half of those non-responders had actually then developed that 50% reduction. So there was a significant subset of individuals who it took longer in order for them to see a benefit. And those individuals were generally heavier, had more psychiatric comorbidities, they had had more treatment failures, and were more likely to have allodynia, global headache, as opposed to just the typical unilateral headache. So what this tells us is that if you've got somebody who's got really stubborn migraines, that you need to treat them for at least 12 weeks, and that for some individuals, you might need to treat longer before you chalk things up to just a complete treatment failure.
Yeah, it's really interesting to find out what the persistence is of these. You know, that what we're learning about today is in these first couple of studies is prognosis and what we can expect in terms of the duration of treatment. So I thought that was very interesting. These folks, it's really terrible. When I was a resident, there was the Michigan Headache and Neurologic Institute in Chelsea, Michigan. And the residents, we would do the intake physicals and make $20. I'll have you know, $20 to do an intake physical for this institute after hours. And the stories were just heartbreaking. I mean, these people were coming from all over the country to this institute to, you know, have try to get some relief. And it's good to see. These must be the cheapest monoclonal antibodies ever, $600 a month. Or maybe that's what the cost is in Italy, or that's here.
That was at goodrx.com.
Okay. Wow.
Yep. Interesting.
Kate, any comments on this one?
Yeah, I do think they're getting cheaper. They're sort of, you know, they're coming to more reasonable market costs. A few years ago, I think I talk about this study a lot. We had a study about Botox for chronic migraines, for daily chronic migraines. And one of the most interesting things that I learned from that study was it was not a super impressive, it worked a little bit, didn't work great. The Botox part didn't, but they had a run-in period. And during the run-in period, people had completed headache diary, and they had to adhere to using just a regular triptan for symptoms. And what they found was that having regular access to the triptans and having better control of episodic headaches significantly reduced the number of episodic headaches that they had. So just having better control of headaches when you got them also improved chronic headaches. And I think about that study all the time because I think, you know, over time, I wonder if that same effect may be being seen with some of the newer medications. So I do wonder too if some of these associations are really going to shake out when we have better studies or if they're just associations.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Okay, well, it's my turn to talk about CBT. This was study was called Efficacy of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Targeting Severe Fatigue Following Coronavirus Disease 2019, results of a randomized controlled trial. It was in Clinical Infectious Diseases, volume 77, page 687, came from Coot, was the first author. So severe fatigue is a prominent and potentially disabling part of post-acute COVID syndrome or long COVID. This trial was done in the Netherlands, and they identified 114 Dutch adults with severe fatigue severe fatigue beginning with or substantially worsened by COVID, and it had to persist at least 3 to 12 months after the onset of the acute infection. So the groups were balanced at the beginning of the study with a mean age of 46 years. 11% had been hospitalized for COVID. Most were female, and I believe they were almost entirely unvaccinated. So this was a fairly early group in the pandemic. They were randomized to an average of 18 weeks of CBT or care as usual. The analysis was by intention to treat. They only lost a few patients in each group to follow-up, and the CBT included things like goal setting, targeting a regular sleep-week pattern, developing helpful thinking patterns, developing some social support, graded gradual increases in activity, and several other components. It was delivered online via telehealth due to the pandemic. You can find more details in an appendix to the study if you're interested. So the primary outcome was a 20-item checklist that ranged from 8 to 56, with higher scores indicating worse fatigue. At baseline, the average score was 48 points in both groups, so that's very high. Clinical response was evaluated at the end of treatment at 19 weeks and about 2 months after that at 26 weeks. The difference in fatigue scores at 19 weeks, 9 points lower with CBT than usual care, and at 26 weeks, where it was a little over 8 points lower, both favored cognitive behavioral therapy. Both would be considered clinically and statistically significant. I think even Henry might agree with that. And Henry will be glad to know the percentage of participants no longer having severe fatigue, so the clinical response, which they defined as a score less than 35, which still sounds kind of fatigue, but maybe not severe, was much higher for the CBT group, 63% versus 26%, number needed to treat of only 3. Other secondary outcomes favored CBT. They weren't any serious adverse events. You wouldn't really expect that. So bottom line, for patients with severe fatigue 3 or more months after COVID, cognitive behavioral therapy does offer a significant improvement over care as usual. Gary?
Has there been a CBT study that has never had some effect?
None that have been published.
on fracture healing, maybe. I don't know.
But, brain tumors, whatever. No, but I mean, the thing is there are a lot of psychosocial factors that perpetuate symptoms and a lot of things, right? And we just don't necessarily know about them. We don't think about them, guys, as people. And I fall in that category, too. We get into negativistic thinking and all those kinds of things. So I love this study. I mean, as you point out, there's no downside. I think they also looked at measures of physical and social and somatic function and concentration problems, a whole bunch of secondary outcomes, which supports the primary outcome, meaning that all these secondary outcomes were also substantially improved in the CBT versus the usual care group. So, yeah, no, I love this study. I love the idea of CBT.
Kate, do you love the idea of CBT?
I feel like that's a really loaded question.
Why don't you?
She loves mindfulness.
Why don't you?
She's a mindfulness expert. Come on.
Yeah, I love it too. Seems great. It's the problem here. I mean, the reason I especially love it here is that we don't have anything else.
Correct. Yeah.
And so, yeah, what's not to like? I always do caution. You know, the reason that CBT works so well is that it's really easy to study. There may be other kinds of psychotherapy or other kinds of interventions that do work, but CBT is just like the modality that is particularly easy to study. So especially for mental health conditions, which this one isn't necessarily, but it is, you know, you can't standardize interpersonal therapy, for example, whereas you can for CBT.
Yeah. Henry, you had a comment?
Yeah. So I will argue that we don't have anything else. So we recently did a poem on if you give metformin at the onset of symptoms, that in obese or overweight patients, that there's a reduction in long COVID, the number needed to treat of about 25. And then in the upcoming January issue of Medicine, Science, Sports, and Exercise, there's a systematic review of aerobic exercise to improve symptoms and at least some of the symptoms in patients with long COVID.
What journal?
Medicine, Science, Sports, and Exercise. It's the official journal of the American College of Sports Medicine.
Okay. And they found that exercise works, did they?
Yeah, it's a systematic review. Yeah.
Hold it. Hold the presses. Well, and this is kind of CBT plus. I mean, when I tend to think of CBT, I tend to think of the goal setting and the developing helpful thinking patterns. But then this also, you know, and maybe this is often part of CBT, but I just don't know that. But graded increase in activity sounds kind of specific to long COVID and developing social support. I mean, those sound like they may be targeting it or adapting it to long COVID.
Yeah, and oh, sorry, last thing, they were also developed socials, but go out and make some friends, not helpful. But I feel like graded activity has come under some fire recently in the treatment of chronic fatigue syndrome, that it had been sort of a mainstay of treatment, and then they were sort of like, maybe back off on that, that it could actually make it worse. So, yeah. You know, TBD.
Yeah. Why don't you have more friends?
Is that a personal?
Who would respond positively to that statement?
Okay.
Mark? I can see why you're retired now.
Yeah. Tell us more about your stamps.
Okay. All right, Gary. You got several lists here. Did AI write this one for you too?
You did. Well, it did. And you did too. So I'm going to give you some credit here. So. I actually learned something looking at this. There's something called an umbrella systematic review, which is a systematic review of systematic reviews. So who knew? You know, maybe you guys did. I didn't. My question is that if you do another level of this, what could you call it? And I came up with a name, Mark. Parachute systematic review. What do you think about that, huh?
I think that's brilliant. Yes. Okay, go ahead, Gary.
I didn't know you could do a systematic review of systematic reviews. It's kind of like, okay.
Anyways. You can do a systematic review on any study design, including systematic reviews. That's
well, this is a study design that reinforces what we're already doing. So I like that also, you know, that after years and years and years of using anti-lipid agents, you know, statins are still the drug to use. So this is the umbrella systematic review of lipid-lowering therapies for cardiovascular disease prevention. Looked at 7, including statins, of course, but it looked at Zetia, which is ezetimibe, fibrates, Tricor, niacin, omega-3 supplements, both with and without EPA, and or DHA, excuse me, and PCSK9 inhibitors, and all compared them to statins. There was a total of 76 systematic reviews that they, yet again, systematically reviewed, 4 randomized trials, looking at 3 basic outcomes, MACEs, major adverse cardiovascular events, cardiovascular death, and all-cause mortality. So the as perhaps everybody would intuit, the statins are continuing to hold up after, you know, all these years as being the number one agent for both primary and secondary prevention when it comes to all 3 of those outcomes in both primary and secondary prevention. When you look at some of the other drugs, such as the ezetimibe, the PCSK9 inhibitors, the fibrates, etc., they all have some evidence for decreasing MACEs, but there's very little, if any, evidence, at least in the systematic review, for that they decrease mortality, their all-cause or cardiovascular mortality. Drugs that I used when I was growing up, were bile acid sequestrants and niacin, have no cardiovascular benefit. And it's interesting, when you look at the fish oils, the omega-3 fatty acids, a lot of it depends on whether or not it's a combination of DHA or EPA or just EPA alone. So there's some differential there with the combination of the EPA and DHA having less effect than the one which only has EPA in it. PCSK9 inhibitors, which have been out now probably for about 7 or 8 years, again, only decreasing MACEs. Now, Mark, you've done a good job. Thank you for that. Doing the NNTs, looking at, for the most part, all comers when it comes to this idea of statins. So when you're looking at the decreasing MACEs, somebody, you have to treat 40 patients over 10 years to decrease 1 MACE. And again, when we're talking about millions and millions of people, that turns out to be a lot of people. And then when you're looking at cardiovascular mortality specifically, the NNT goes up to 200 over 10 years. Commonly used medications, certainly that was a strength of the article. It focused on patient-oriented outcomes, which is important. There's some concerns about limitations that potential overrepresentation of older trials may have muddied the waters a little bit. Presumably, that's a problem with some of these systematic reviews because they used older trials. And if you're doing a systematic review of a systematic review, you can't exclude those necessarily. So it just reinforces, I think, what we've known for years. I like that idea that it's continuing to be proven, essentially, as being effective therapy for patient-oriented outcomes. Statins.
Thanks, Gary. Kate?
Not a lot to add. I had heard of umbrella reviews before. I'm sorry, Gary. But the
parachute learn about them at a whole lecture.
I think it's interesting that the with the prescription strength omega-3 supplements, which I think is an interesting the whole concept of fish oils and omega-3 is an interesting part of medicine, that the Lovaza, the combined, which I know comes in a different dose of EPAs than the Vascepa, which is the purified Vascepa or the EPAs only, that they have different evidence pools to support their use. That's an interesting takeaway. But all in all, I feel like, you know, all this evidence, when you put it together, kind of tells us what we essentially already know, which is statins first and then everything else, only if you can't tolerate it or have some other reason to add something. Yeah.
Henry?
Yeah, I have a couple of comments. The first is that the Canadian Family Physician periodically publishes these peer systematic reviews. I don't remember what peer stands for, but they're generally very well done. And they often will try to incorporate really clinically meaningful endpoints. We've done some where the endpoints had to include 30% reductions in pain or 50% reductions in pain, those things that allow us to be able to determine clinically meaningful endpoints. And so this is one that I think is good to draw our attention to. I like the idea of umbrella reviews, but I'm not quite sure I like the how they are incorporated. So, for example, we've seen lots of systematic reviews, some of which can include only randomized trials, some will include everything, including the kitchen sink, and, you know, pay no attention to study quality or other methodologic limitations. And so my fear is that umbrella reviews will actually water down the real effects or overestimate the real effects. And so I'm still trying to figure out what's the proper role for these other than for academic job security.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Gary made the point that, you know, the results in older trials may be quite different from newer trials. We saw that with aspirin for primary prevention, where it seemed to work quite well in the 1980s when we weren't giving anybody statins or we weren't really doing very well with blood pressure. Now that we're doing a lot of other things, as like better control of diabetes, better control of hypertension, it may be that statins currently might not have as big an effect as they would have had 30 years ago. We don't know that. That would be interesting to look at the difference in, you know, effect sizes for older studies versus newer. And I had the same question about what the hell does peer stand for? Nowhere in any of their publications do they say it. I contacted my friend Roland Grad, who's a Canadian family physician and professor at McGill, and he sent me to their website, and it's called Patients Experience Evidence Research, which I don't know quite what that means.
Hey, it's got evidence and patients in there.
Evidence research. It's kind of too hard to get. You do great work. I shouldn't be too hard on you. Really
patients do great experience
work.
Evidence what? Research?
Research.
It doesn't even sound like those words should go together.
It's like they're missing a verb. Or a few, like.
That's what I'm looking at their logo. And the only place I could find it was in their actual logo, which has a bunch of looking like male physicians in a stack in a row. Yeah, they need to work on their marketing a bit, I think. But they do great work. Keep coming here, folks. Thank you. Go Canada. Woo.
Maybe those are just their values or something. Maybe that's not their.
Yeah. Maybe. We'll have to, you know, I'm sure we'll get angry hate mail. Send it to henberry@gmail.com.
But I want to be clear. Can you do an umbrella review of an umbrella review? Is that?
Well, there was a systematic review of publication or looking at publication bias in studies of publication bias. So that was sort of a meta.
I got to think about that.
Yeah, I've seen that one. Okay, we got the quiz. We got the quiz. Before we go. It's 31 minutes. We're overdoing it here. Christmas cheer. For which of the following is there randomized controlled evidence of reduced pain following total knee arthroplasty? And so I am the worst patient in the world because I go and do research on it and think that I know more than my doctor, who actually already knows quite a bit because they're doing the right things for me, as I found out yesterday in my pre-op visit. So there's a 2023 or 2022 guideline from the European Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Therapy. Great guideline. Really focused on systematic reviews and randomized trials, did a nice job of looking at benefits and harms. They concluded that the evidence was really pretty mixed for gabapentin, at best maybe some relief the first day, given the side effects, they don't recommend it. dexamethasone was helpful, and they are going to give me some tomorrow. Yay. Adductor canal nerve blocks are recommended as effective, and they don't interfere with strength or function. I'm getting one of those too. Local infiltration of analgesics is also effective and recommended, and they're going to do that. So I'm really quite pleased. Of course, round-the-clock NSAIDs, acetaminophen, ice elevation are recommended for these patients. And the femoral nerve block, which you think might be effective, actually isn't recommended because it had negative effects on function and strength and the ability to, participate with physical therapy. So somebody added, what, no biting on a stick or heavy doses of alcohol? Well, there will at least be some alcohol involved, I can guarantee you.
So Mark, I don't see Dilaudid on this list anywhere. What gets with that?
Oxy. Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you want CME credit, go to the IAFP.com. You can get a half an AMA Category 1 credit for filling out a little quiz, I guess. I've never done it. I'm sure that's what it is. Hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends about Primary Care Update. Subscribe to us on wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates.